This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Age-old question of the relationship of a Jew to his money. What motivation are we meant to have in the earning of money? How hard are we supposed to work in earning money? What are we supposed to do with the money we do earn? What's the attitude? What is the attitude of the Torah that a man should have towards his material possessions? And in so doing, in clarifying that problem, which is a major problem, and one which causes a lot of confusion and distortion of Torah views and attitudes, we will also clarify the essence of the difficulty that the Am Yisrael had, the difficulties that the Am Yisrael had when they were going through the desert. We see all the various problems that Moshe Rabbeinu had in putting up with them, and sometimes very difficult to understand that a people had seen all those miracles could go through that kind of rebellious period as they did. We'll understand a little clearer this evening what it was, what was at the bottom of their frustration, what it was that made them unhappy. And it's really a continuation of last week's shiur in the sense that we discussed last week of the two modes of existence. The acquisitive society, a society where one's security is built on possession, and the spiritual society where one is secure through the things one does, not through the things one has. And that mon was food, but as little material as possible in the food itself. It couldn't be accumulated, it couldn't be saved, it couldn't be invested, it couldn't be bought, it couldn't be sold. That's how it was. You could just eat it. There was nothing else you could do with it but eat it. And we said that for security, one really needs to have meaning in the past, meaning in the present, and meaning in the future. And we said that in the acquisitive society, meaning of the past is achieved through possessions. I show my uniqueness. I have been able to work for these possessions which make me different from everybody else. One's future is through investment, and one's present is through distraction. You know, when they put in the speed limits, the sales of CB radios shut up. Very simple, why people get bored driving. Now, to me it was the biggest bracha. So it's going to take you another 3 minutes to get from your house to the office. It's another 3 minutes of quiet, uninterrupted, undisturbed thinking time. There's no telephone, nobody can get hold of you, there's nothing to disturb you, you just have to keep your eye on the road more or less, and you've got 15-20 minutes to think. There's no problem. And it's going to take a little bit longer, how much better? And it's not bittles none, it's not a waste of time, you don't feel that you're wasting time, because that's the law, you can only drive at that speed. So it's wonderful. So people put radios in their motor cars. Okay. So you can put on some light music and you can still think. But CB radios, you've got to put yourself on the telephone for the only couple of minutes in the day that you're free from the telephone. Meshuggah. But in the acquisitive society, the only way one can handle the present is by being distracted. That's all. A radio on, a gramophone on, go to the movies, go out, have people over, go to people. Whatever it is, just distract me from the present. So as to be busy during the present. That's all that's important, that I don't have a present. That's how the acquisitive society handles the present. Because what can you do? You can't eat your tables and chairs and motor cars and house. And if you've had your food already, you're not hungry, you can't even eat your food. So what do you do in the acquisitive society? The shops are closed, you come home at 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock, and you're free. There's nothing to do. You can't buy anything, you can't work. So you go to bed, or you watch TV, or you go to friends, or you play cards. That's the acquisitive society. Not so in the Torah society. In the Torah society, the past, that we don't worry about. That we handle with tshuva. If anything's been done wrong in the past, we fix it. The future, that we don't worry about. That's handled with emunah. And bitochen, we rely on the Ribbono Shel Olam. We take certain measures, we take certain steps, we invest, we take out insurance policies, all the normal things, and then we forget about it. The present, that's the whole Torah is about the present. How to live the present. But that's a spiritual society. Now we're going to go a little bit further in that concept. The Torah counts up the number of Am Yisrael in this week's Seder and goes to a lot of effort to recount exactly who they were and how many there were. And finally the Torah tells us the number and says, Uva Eile, and among these, Lo hayo ish mipekudei Moshe v'Aaron HaKohen. There was no man from the counting of Moshe and Aaron the Kohen, Asher pokdu es b'nei Yisrael b'midbar Sinai, when they counted the Am Yisrael the first time in Midbar Sinai, just at the time of the giving of the Torah, there are none of those people. There's none of those left. These are all new men. Says Rashi, why does the Torah use the word ish? should say there was no man, or no person. Why there was no man? Aval al hanoshim lo nigru gzeira samaraglim. Says Rashi, there were women who've survived since the time of coming out of Egypt. It was only the men who didn't survive since the time of coming out of Egypt. And imagine that people who say the Torah discriminates against women. The men were all wiped out, but there were women who survived from the time of the coming out of Mitzrayim to the time of the coming in of Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because they loved Eretz Yisrael. They loved Eretz Yisrael. They got to Eretz Yisrael. Ha'anoshim omrim, the men say, Nisna Rosh v'noshuva Mitzrayimah. After they hear the story of the Meraglim, after they hear the story of the spies, that Eretz Yisrael is a terrible place, and it's going to be hard to conquer it and hard to live in it, they say, let's choose a new leader, and back to Mitzrayim we go. Ha'anoshim omrim, t'na lanu achuzo. And the women say, we demand a stake in Eretz Yisrael. That's why the very next parsha is the parsha of the daughters of Tzlofchad, where they come to Moshe Rabbeinu and they say, not fair, just because we have no brothers we get no land. We want land. There are many questions on this Rashi, how you learn it from the Bnei Tzlofchad and where you see it in the Bnei Tzlofchad, etc., etc., etc. But we are going to deal with only one aspect of the Rashi this evening, and that is, what's the machlokes between the men and the women? The women love Eretz Yisrael and the men love Mitzrayim. Let's understand the essence of Eretz Yisrael and the essence of Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim as a typical country of Chutz Loretz, a typical materialist country. Eretz Yisrael as the other one. Let's try and understand why the men wanted to go back to Mitzrayim. Do you know what it was after the experience they had in Mitzrayim? They wanted to go back. But people find it very difficult to understand how German people, people who survived the war, are going back to Germany today. Going back and they're living there and setting up businesses and families there, young people, old people, huge families. There's a huge Jewish community building up in Germany again. It can be understood. It's not so difficult to understand. One sees the same tendency right here. What the Jews suffered in Mitzrayim was much worse than what went on in Germany. They were being wiped out and enslaved. Now, this was miserable. This was 400 years of it, 210 years of it. Whereas that was only 5 years. Much worse did they suffer. And yet within a few years of having coming out of Eretz Israel, of Eretz Mitzrayim, Nisna Rosh v'noshuva Mitzrayim, there's already a desire, because there are going to be some difficulties in living in Eretz Yisrael, let's get back to Mitzrayim, let's get back to Egypt. One has to understand it. Says the Klei Yakov. Before the Klei Yakov, let's just look at the essence of the difference between Mitzrayim and Eretz Yisrael. The Torah tells us what the difference is. It's a pasuk in Akev in Devarim chapter Yud Aleph, verse Yud. Moshe tells them, Ki ha'oretz asher atov asham l'rishto, the land which you are coming to inherit, loch Eretz Mitzrayim, he is not like Eretz Mitzrayim. So here we're going to see the differences. What is it? Eretz Yisrael, what is Mitzrayim? Asher yotzatzem mishon, from which you have just come. Asher tizro es zaracho, v'hishkiso beraglocho kegan hayorot. In Eretz Mitzrayim, it's very simple. There you plant your fields, and you water it like you water a garden. In other words, you have to arrange irrigation. But the land to which you're coming now to inherit, Eretz Horim of the coast, it's a land, not a flat land, but a land of hills and valleys. Limetar hashomayim tishtemayim. It drinks its water from rainfalls, not from irrigation schemes. Eretz asher Hashem Elokecha doresh oto. It's a land which the Rabbeinu Shalom watches. Tomid all the time, Eine Hashem Elokecha bo. The eyes of God are watching it. Mereshis Hashono v'ad Achris Hashono, from the beginning of the year until the end of the year. That's the difference between Eretz Yisrael and Eretz Mitzrayim. In Eretz Mitzrayim you need irrigation, there's an environmental difference. In Eretz Mitzrayim you need irrigation, in Eretz Yisrael, rainfall. There's another difference. There are certain halachas which are different, particularly halachas of agriculture. For example, truma, maaser, challah, all these things that you have to separate and give to the kohen and give to the katzos, and the kohens, that we don't have to do in Chutz Laretz, only in Eretz Yisrael. The Yalkut brings a medrash which says that this part of this, of the second pasuk which I read you, the third pasuk, Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Oso, a land which the Rabbeinu Shalom has an interest in, that's how to read it really, he has an interest in this land, says the Yalkut Shimoni, that is Challah, Truma and Maaser. In other words, the Yalkut Shimoni points out that this pasuk is actually relating the two differences between Eretz Yisrael and Eretz Mitzrayim, the environmental difference and the halachic difference. An environmental difference being the method of irrigation, and the halakhic difference being the dinim of Truma and Maisa. That's what the Yalkut says. Says the Klayoka, a wonderful Chiddush. He says the Yalkut in fact is saying more. The Yalkut is saying that the halakhic differences of Eretz Yisrael, the halakhic uniqueness of Eretz Yisrael, in fact emerges from the environmental difference. It's because of the environmental difference that there are halakhic differences. What does that mean? In Eretz Yisrael, you do all the work yourself. You want a field, you've got to plant it. You want water, you've got to go and fetch it from the Nile. That's the only source of water. And you've got to carry it and have it carried or whatever it is and bring it and water. That's the way to do it. In Eretz Yisrael, not so. In Eretz Yisrael, the Ribbono Shel Olam is a partner with you. You plant and he waters. That's the deal. When the Ribbono Shel Olam is a partner, he wants a share of the profits. So he took 10% or whatever it is, the Truma and the Maisa, just over 10% plus the Challah. The various halachas which are fixed as to what you have to give to the Kohanim is the Ribbono Shel Olam share for what he does in the development of your land and the development of your business. Fair enough. And now says the Klei Yoka an interesting thing. This that the men didn't want to go back to Eretz Yisrael from Mitzrayim is because they weren't prepared to pay the tax. 10% the Ribbono Shel Olam wants them to pay, they're not prepared to do that. They would rather water their own fields. That's what the Klei Yoka says. That was their claim. And this we have to understand, it just doesn't make sense. All the effort, all the expense of arranging irrigation, and look at the research that they do in Eretz Yisrael today, because Eretz Yisrael today isn't fully like Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be, so it can't rely on rainfall only, so they've also got to arrange irrigation. And look at the research universities are put up, millions are poured into research irrigation, and then actually doing it, and getting the water, and the pipelines, and laying them, and figuring them out, and operating them, and running them. The effort, the energy that goes into irrigation, and how much more so in a place like Egypt where your only source of water is the Nile, where you have no other source of water, and you have to irrigate the whole land from that one source of water, and there is no rainfall at all. The fortunes would have to be put to Aswan Dam. And he would rather pay for the Aswan Dam than give 10% to the Beis HaMikdash for Truma. This doesn't make sense. Right? But anybody who learned through the Klei Yoka, that should have been the kasha you had on the Klei Yoka. You had that kasha on the Klei Yoka. Did you answer it? Okay, that's the kasha on the Klei Yoka. And it's that we're going to understand. We're going to understand the Yisod, we're going to understand the principle that the Klei Yoka enunciates here, and with that we'll understand the Pasuk. It's a curse of the on man since the time of Adam, of Bezeyas Apecha Toicha Lachem. You want to eat, you have to work. That's it, it's a curse, it's a klola. But now that it's a klola, it's part of nature. That's just how the world operates. You want to eat, you've got to work. You've got to work for your food. You ought to sweat for it, work hard for it. The acquisitive society, how does it see the fruits of its work? If I live in the acquisitive society, so I'm going to give my life to this. I'm going to get up in the morning and work and slave and think and suffer heart attacks and ulcers to establish a business, to run a business, to operate a business. How do I see the fruits of it? I buy things. I work. Through my work I earn money. With the money I buy things. And the nachas I get from the things I have is what compensates me for the energy I put in. I've worked, but this is my work. Look at my house. Look at my car. The paintings on our wall. Look at our crystal glasses. Look at our Persian carpets. Look at our silverware. That's my energy. That's my work. It's worthwhile. It's good. That's how the acquisitive society stays sane. Otherwise you work and work and work and you've got nothing to show for it. It's very important for one's own security and sanity to have something to show for one's work. And it's through that he builds up a security. And a man then becomes what he earns. Right? He becomes a millionaire. You now talk about a man. You define a man as a millionaire. What is he? He is a millionaire. Not is he a nice man or is he an awful man? Is he a Baal Midas or isn't he? Is a Talmid Chochem or Amaoretz? All those classifications disappear. Now he's a millionaire or he's not a millionaire. Or he's a managing director or he's not a managing director. Or his company is public or it isn't public. That's how you define people now in the acquisitive society. But we sometimes do something else with money. Right? In the acquisitive society, it's work, money, things. But even in the acquisitive society, we occasionally do other things. For example, you'll find a man will go and spend money for which he's worked to go to a concert. What have you got to show for it afterwards? The concert's over, everything's finished. What have you got? Nothing. Doesn't matter. He justifies it in various ways. Justifies his relaxation. In order to carry on with my work and to be able to buy more silverware and more Persian carpets, etc., etc. You're late, you wicked ladies. order to justify it. So he says it's relaxation, it's entertainment. He's got all sorts of words for it. There's a chair over here, there are two chairs over here. It's relaxation, it's entertainment, it's the only way you can carry on tomorrow. Sometimes you need a bit of such relaxation, and he goes, but it's not always like that. Sometimes you'll even see a person who will do it because he loves the music, not relaxation. It would be more relaxing to go to bed. In fact, it's Mesirat Nefesh to go to the concert. Apart from spending money on it, he also doesn't have the time for it. And he'll find the time, and he'll push, and he'll get there. You'll find people who take their life savings, and they go to the Salzburg Festival. They save and save for years, and they get themselves an airway ticket, and they book themselves in hotels in Salzburg, and off they go to hear the music at Salzburg, or to the Wagner Opera Festival. Whatever it is, they go. You'll find people whole life savings. You'll find young people, particularly, who spend a lot of money on traveling, meeting people, hearing lectures, going to art exhibitions. How does that fit into the acquisitive society? What have you got left after this? So you see that there is such a thing as spending money on an experience too. But that's not acquisitive. The acquisitive society man really gets nothing out of it and doesn't do it. If he goes to a concert, it's either because it's relaxation, or because he wants to be seen there, or because he wants to see other people there, or because it's a habit, or whatever it is, or that's the thing one does. There might be many reasons why the acquisitive man will go to the concert in the first place. But a spiritual man will be moser nefesh to go, and he'll pay with that hard-earned money. Off he'll go, and he'll spend that hard-earned money on a concert, and he won't feel bad at all. And he'll look at the acquisitive man, and he'll say, spend 6,000 rand on a motor car? Are you crazy? A motor car? What can a motor car do for you? And the acquisitive man looks at the spiritual man, says, spend 4,000 rand going overseas to a concert in the sugar? You come back, you've got no 4,000 rand, you've got no motor car. At least I've got a motor car. They're just operating on different planes, and there's no way they can relate to one another. And the acquisitive man needs more and more. It's a quantitative thing, as we discussed last week. Because the moment he's got something, he ceases to live until he gets something else. So his whole life is devoted to getting more and more and more. He wants another thing in the latest fashion, and new furniture, and change the curtains, and move house, and a new car, and trade in the old car, and all the time, new and new and new. That's the way he lives. The spiritual man, not necessarily. He can go to a concert once in 10 years, and that lives with him, that's changed him, that's an experience. And then he finds other things to do, and other ways of getting his experiences. In other words, the spiritual man is living in the present, and he's living through the things he's doing. And when you're busy doing, you've got no existential problems. All these existential problems that arose in the 60s, particularly in the 60s and in the late 50s, came out of Beatles band, out of people who had too much time on their hands. So they didn't feel alive. They weren't doing. And they couldn't identify with the acquisitive society, neither did they need to identify with the acquisitive society, because whatever they wanted, their fathers gave them. So what did they have to do? So they started wondering, are they really alive? And what is life? And how do you feel alive? And is life worthwhile? And is life meaningful? A person who's busy, a person who's doing, a person who's experiencing the present doesn't stop to think it's worthwhile. Of course it's worthwhile. We'll see in a moment how worthwhile it is. Can you imagine an acquisitive society man where the whole economy is driven towards work, money, spending? I mean, that's what the Western society is built on. The whole thing collapses if people stop working, or if people stop earning, or if people stop spending. I mean, that's what it's all based on. Work. And by the way, in this whole shiur, I'm leaving investment out. That's another subject altogether. Investment, we're leaving right out. But one works, earns, spends. That's what it's all about. Can you imagine a meshuggah in an acquisitive society who will buy time with his money? Let's say he could buy time with his money. That's ridiculous. That's going backwards. You don't buy time with your money. You use your time to earn money. Sure. That was what happened in Mitzrayim, and that's what the Jews liked. In Mitzrayim, you work much harder, but you earn more. What is the deal that the Ribbono Shel Olam is offering you in Eretz Yisrael? He's saying to you, look, you don't have to work so hard. Take some time off. The time you're spending on irrigation, you can go to the Beis Hamidrash and you can learn. Or you can do chesed in tzedakah. Or you can be nice to people. You can spend time with your family. You can read. You can learn. You can hear. You can go to music. You can go to art exhibitions. Do what you want. Grow a little bit. The time you would have spent on irrigation. But, nothing for nothing, 10% you give to the Beis HaMikdash. A man who has an acquisitive problem doesn't accept such a deal. That's against the whole economy. And we discussed last week that the basis of all the problems of Am Yisrael in the desert was their overreaction to the slavery. And the fact that their tendency was to find security in an acquisitive sense, in the sense of having physical things, the eagle, the problem with conquering Eretz Yisrael, the Meraglim, the problem last week with the Mon, they couldn't handle the Mon because it wasn't acquisitive enough. It didn't give you a sense of holding something in your hand, as Rabbeinu Bechaya said. And it couldn't be kept, it couldn't be saved, it couldn't be spent. It was just something that you could do with, you could only eat with it, it couldn't give you any other fulfillment other than doing, and they weren't doing people yet. They were people who had their, or who desired to have their experience and their pleasures out of having, not out of doing. If that's the case, there's no way you can accept the deal of the Ribbono Shel Olam Eretz Yisrael. I'm going to have more time, but what do I need more time for? I need to earn more money, so what's the point of the deal? You're going to give me more time and cut my salary? No ways. Then that's not the idea of going into Eretz Yisrael. The idea of going into Eretz Yisrael is that you'll have more time. What's the whole purpose of earning? We live in a spiritual society, not in an acquisitive society. Yes, b'zeya tapecha toicha lochem. You have to work to earn a living. Sure, so it starts working and then earning. Now comes the question, what do you do with your money? There are two things you can do with your money. You can buy things, and you can buy experiences. Right? And to buy experiences is what the Torah requires we do with our money. Not to buy things. We'll see in a moment how one buys things and where there's a place for buying things. But in principle, there is no justification whatever in spending money on buying things. You spend money on experiences. Hillel used to have to chop wood to get the money to pay to go into the Beis HaMikdash. That's it. That's how it should be. Spend money on experience, not on things. What about things? You know, sometimes to do certain things you need tools. And we are permitted to buy those things we need in order to do. You can't make Kiddush on Shabbos if you don't have no wine. You can't make a motzi if you don't have challahs. In fact, you can't have a Shabbos if you don't have meat and fish and a schnapsel and a bit of wine and so on. You don't have a Shabbos. So in order to have a Shabbos, you need certain gashmius, you need certain material things, so you're allowed to buy them. You can't operate successfully and function correctly if you don't have a house, a roof over your head, so you're entitled to buy a house. If you have a house, the house should be a pleasant place to live in, you're entitled to make it a pleasant place to live in. And if you want to do a lot of entertaining, you're entitled to design your house in such a way that you can do entertaining, that you can have people, that you can be machnis ochim. And if you need a car in order to go to work to earn your living to be machnis oreach, you need money to be machnis oreach. It's not easy to entertain, it's not cheap to entertain. So you decide that entertaining is one of the things you enjoy doing, and you feel it's a contribution you can make to Torah and to the world. So you've got to work a little bit harder to earn the money with which to entertain. Okay, and you need a car to earn that money, so you buy a car, that's okay. But we're buying physical things in order to do with them, not to have them. We are not permitted to find pleasure and happiness and security in what we have. There you're coming onto Avodah Zorah, really. You're making the little things you've got, little gods that are giving you security. Security is through doing. Security is through experiencing the Ribbono Shel Olam by that which we do. You only can feel godliness when you're doing godly things. That's the only way you can experience God. And that's all we're permitted to do. And we're permitted to buy those tools that we need in order to do it. And you can find one man who doesn't need much at all. He can live in a little hovel and he can eat bread and water and he can do whatever he needs to feel totally fulfilled. And you can have another man who needs a little bit more than that. Each one according to his needs. But it's the needs of doing, not the needs of having. Nobody has any needs of having except the barest minimums, which we'll look at in a moment. So the criticism of Am Yisrael and the reason for which they had to dray around another 40 years in the desert was acquisitive. You're not prepared to buy time with money. That's it. You're not prepared to buy time with money. The women, they're prepared to. They don't mind. Work a little bit harder. See a little bit less of your husband. No worse. Earn a little bit less. Have a bit more of your husband. Have a better family life. Have a husband who's raising himself in stature, is at the minyan every morning, and is at the shir every night. It's worth it. For that they're prepared to sacrifice. That's what living's all about. That's what life is all about. Life is not eating and sleeping. Life is doing and growing. And they're prepared to do whatever it requires to do and grow. All they want is their basic minimums. Their basic minimums they'll have in Eretz Yisrael. What more do you need than that? We'll see in a moment still what basic minimums are. But the men, they weren't prepared to buy time with money. And it's Rabbi Avigdor Miller, I think it is, who says that the world says that time is money. We say money is time. It's not a question of how much time I can afford, because time is money. It's how much money can I afford to earn? How much time is it going to take for me to earn my living? That's what I've got to decide. My currency is time. You know, it works with money that way as well. It doesn't mean anything anymore to say that this is worth 5 rand. And what's a rand worth? Well, a rand is worth $1.19 or whatever it is. And what's a dollar worth? A dollar's worth so many and so many pounds sterling. And what's a pound sterling worth? It just doesn't mean anything. That's why you have to have gold. You have to have something at the end of the day that you can measure worth against. This is how much it is worth. So it is with all measurings. Whenever you measure, after all, this is what Einstein came with. Whenever you're measuring, it's relative. You need to have a meter stick by which to measure. Otherwise, your measurement is meaningless. Our meter stick of measurement of value in Torah is time. Because 1 second in time is worth more than the whole world. We'll see just now how much 1 second is worth. But it's like gold. Same as gold is worth, it's inherently and intrinsically valuable. So a million times more than that, infinitely more than that, is 1 second infinitely valuable. And that becomes our measure of value. How many seconds is it going to require for me in order to earn my living or in order to do A, B, C, or D? Because my time, that's something which is irreplaceable and that's something which is valuable beyond all understanding. But you have to be a spiritual person for that. An acquisitive man, time is only in order to earn money. And the measure of your success is how much you earn. Not so with a spiritual man. A spiritual man's measure of success is how I spend my time. Let's see how valuable time is. A few things I'll show you. The one is an incredible medrash in the Yalkut Shimoni in the beginning of Shmos, where it says that the Egyptians started getting worried about the Jews. They were multiplying and sort of taking over the economy generally, and they decided, Hava nitchak malo, let's get clever with them, and they decided the scheme of enslaving them. Says the medrash, Shloisho hoyu b'oiso etza. The king called together a cabinet of three people to discuss the problem, the Jewish problem. Pharaoh called together three people. They were all well-known and famous people who we've met before. The first one was Bilam. What did he do? Yoatz. He gave advice, and what was his punishment? Neherag, he was killed. Later on. Iyov, Job was there as well at that time. Iyov, Sheshosak. He abstained. What was his punishment? Nidun b'yisurim. You know the pain and suffering that poor Iyov went through throughout his life? That was what it was for. Because when Paro asked him advice about what to do with the Jews, he abstained. Yitro, what did Yitro do? Moshe's father-in-law, Sheborach. He didn't come to the meeting at all. Not he wasn't at the meeting and abstained, he fled the country. Zochu bono v'yeshvu b'lishkat ha-gazet. So the children of Yitro had the merit and the privilege of sitting up at the very top in the Beis HaMikdash. Sons of Aaron and Moshe. I can understand that Yitro gets this wonderful privilege as a result of fleeing the country when he was called to give advice on the Jewish problem. I can understand that Bilam is killed because he gives advice on the Jewish problem. And I'm sure that Bilam's punishment must be a million times worse than Iyov's punishment. And Bilam actually encouraged the Egyptians to do what they did. And it might have been because of Bilam that they did it. Iyov didn't. So surely Iyov's punishment is going to be very, very much less than the punishment of Yisro, of Bilam. What's his punishment? Iyov Sheshosak, Nidun B'Yisurim. That whole Sefer Iyov, all those terrible tragedy that Iyov went through, that's the most tragic figure we have in Jewish literature. That's what he gets. Which is worse? Surely dying is better than suffering the life that Iyov did? And that's the whole principle of euthanasia, is that the world accepts that there comes a point when dying is better than suffering. It's not so. Suffering is better than dying. There's a pasuk in Eicha that says, "Ma yisoinen adam chai." What right has a living man got to complain? Says Rashi in Ksubis Daf Pei Amud Beis, "Ma yitoinen adam chai? Lama yitoinen adam chai? Why on earth does a living man complain? Lama yitraim adam ala korot habo talav? Why does a man complain about the sorrows that come his way? After all the incredible chesed and kindness that I, God, do with him, what right have you got to complain for a few miserable tzoros? What's the wonderful chesed? He's got life. That's the incredible chesed. I've given him life, and I've withheld misa from him. I've kept death away from him. And he's got a right to complain? And we're talking about a complainer like Iyov, or a person who's suffering like Iyov has no right to complain. Iyov being the extreme of suffering that we have, has no right at all to complain. because of the overwhelming joy he should experience in one fact, the chesed that he's alive. That's what a second of life means. Imagine a man who's gone through his life, built up a business, and he gets to his later years in life, 75, 80, he looks back, it's been a waste of time. Either the business has collapsed, or he's understood that that isn't what life's all about, to build up a business. And let's say Nebuchadnezzar, he's lost his children, and he's got nobody to leave the business to. And even worse, in a sense, he's got children and they've gone completely off the rails. And they're not interested in his business, they're not interested in his values, they're not interested in anything he held. And he takes to find the truth in my last days of life. That would justify my whole life. If only as I lie here on my deathbed I could come to the conclusion that I know what is MS, that would make my whole life worthwhile. Okay, so it took me 85 years to find the truth, but at least I'll know it. And if I find that God is true, I'll do tshuva before I die. I'll repent, I'll fix my affairs, I'll fix my life, I'll correct my wrongs, and retrospectively that will give meaning to my whole life. And imagine at that point he goes into a semi-coma and he's suffering terribly. And he can't speak and he can't communicate with the outside world. But he's still thinking, he's still working it all out. And he's about to come to the conclusion that Moshe emes v'teirasa emes. As he lies there, he's about to come to the conclusion that Moshe is true and the Torah is true, and that would give his whole life meaning. And they come and they turn off the machine. Never. Why should he suffer? Imagine what you've done to a man. 1 second more and his life would have been worthwhile with all that suffering. The kind-hearted people, the chesed, euthanasia. Why should the man suffer? What right have we got to deprive a man of one moment of his life? Who knows what's going on there? If he's a living man. If he's a dead man before he started. If he's a person who doesn't operate and he has no spirituality. No, I suppose he's not going to do very much, but one doesn't know, because those are the most spiritual moments of a man's life. And as we've said a couple of times this weekend, the prime of a man's life are the last years of his life. That's the time when he really can achieve. And as he lies on his deathbed, that's the time that he sees reality more clearly than anybody who's living. And more than any time that he realized it while he was living. To deprive him of those last seconds of his life for euthanasia, chesed, there's no chesed in it. Ma yis'ona in odom chai. No matter what the tzores are, no matter how hard the suffering and the pain, when you're alive even for 1 second, what you can do, koine olama b'sha'achas, it's possible to buy, to acquire your whole olam haba by one moment of life. Just living one moment correctly and doing the right thing, utilizing your potential to the full in one moment, you can buy, you can get your whole olam haba. And we're going to deprive somebody of that moment? Chas v'shalom. We'll never allow euthanasia, never ever. And you know, it's a bit of a joke almost making such a fuss of euthanasia when we waste our whole lives. And our teens and our 20s and our 30s and our 40s and our 50s and our 60s we waste. All the time, moments every day. When we get old we worry about another second longer, another day longer. It's a bit tragic. Sure, one should worry about those last seconds of one's life and hope that one's clear during those moments and one's able to utilize them correctly. But what about the euthanasia in the present? There's euthanasia going on all the time. Dulling one's senses, dulling one's intellect. Becoming apathetic, not looking around one, not living to the full intensity. That's suicide, not euthanasia. Nobody else is doing it to us. We do it ourselves. Every time, one mustn't look at suicide as something which can happen once in one's life. Every moment can potentially be suicidal or living. Every moment is life. Every second is a full life. And you can either kill that life in that second or live that life. So every moment we have the potential of either committing suicide or living in a real way. One sees how far this concept goes of not complaining about tzoros. The Ribbono Shel Olam expects us to be so overwhelmed by the joy of life, even in the midst of the most terrible trials and tribulations. So much so, let's see to what extent. When Yaakov comes down to Egypt, Yosef is now the prime minister, the king, not the king, the second to the king, and he comes down. Pharaoh and his family, Yaakov and his family, and Yosef has the pride and privilege to introduce his father Yaakov to the king. Both of them men of considerable stature. Yaakov in Torah, and Pharaoh at least in politics and in leadership. And you can imagine Yosef's anticipation of those moments. And they open the conversation with the usual pleasantries. Vayomer Paro el Yaakov, and Paro says to Yaakov, Kamor Yomei Shnei Chayecha, how old are you? Vayomer Yaakov el Paro, and Yaakov says to Paro, Yomei Shnei Megurai Shloshim U'me'as Shono, I'm 130 years, Ma'at v'royim hayu yemei shnei chayai. It's not very much, my life is not very much considering v'lo yisigu yis yemei shnei chayai avosa b'mei megureim. And it's nowhere near the age that my fathers and forefathers achieved while they were traveling around. Asks the Balei HaTosfos, what prompted Paro to ask how old Yaakov was? He must have looked terribly old. He must have looked older than his years. Paro must have been shocked when he met Yaakov. So he was prompted to say, how old are you? I thought you were only 130. And says the Balei HaTosfos, then brings the Medrash that Yaakov's life was shortened by the number of words in these sentences, starting from Kama Yemei Shnei Chayecho, how old are you? Starting from Paro's question till the end of Yaakov's answer, there are 33 letters, and Yaakov lived 33 years shorter than his father Yitzchak. Asked the Balei HaTosfos, why should Paro's question be included in the 33 letters? I understand that Yaakov shouldn't have complained. Should have said, I'm answered straight, I'm 130 years old. Shouldn't have said, I know I look old and I'm nowhere near as old as I look and I'm nowhere near as old as my parents were. Okay, I can understand that. So I can understand that his life is shortened by that amount. It's a pretty severe judgment for a man who loves life the way we're talking. But to cut out also Paro's question, what's that got to do with Yaakov, that Paro asks him how old he is? Says the Balei HaTosfos, there should have been no reason for Paro to ask how old you were. He asked how old you were because you were grey and you looked old. You had no right to look older than your age. That's it. It shows that you're suffering, and the suffering is telling. That means that your suffering is more than your joy, and you've taken it badly. Your body has no right to age badly, because it's a psychological thing. Old age is not something physical. Old age is something of attitude and psychology. One sees, look at what happened to Yitzchak. And the Medrash actually says, Yitzchak, how can you say such a thing? I saved you from Lavan. I saved you from Esav. I've returned your child to you. I've returned Yosef to you. And you've got the chutzpah to complain about how miserable your life has been. That's difficult to understand. Okay, the Ribbono Shel saved him from Esav and saved him from Lavan and has returned his son. But who put him into Lavan's hands in the first place? Who put him into Esav's hands in the first place? Who took Yosef away from him in the first place? Very nice. I go and I bash somebody up, give him a black eye, break his arms and legs, and say, you should say thank you to me that I didn't kill you. But yes, that's how it is. The Ribbono Shel Olam has given us life, and the joy of that life has to overwhelm any thought of tzoras, any problems that one can have. Just don't come anywhere close to the wonders and to the joy of being alive. The Rosh Yeshiva of Mir used to say, it's like a man who wins a lottery for 100,000 rand, and he goes around crying, and you say, why are you crying? You say, because my wife dropped a glass in the kitchen today and it broke. Sugar, what's the... Despite what we said last night, that one has to be able to feel sadness and joy together, and one doesn't mix one's emotions up, one doesn't cancel them out, but still, there comes a time when the one is the overwhelming one and the other shouldn't show. One might feel it, but it shouldn't show. One last chazal to illustrate the value of time. In Pirkei Avos, chapter Dalet, Mishnah Yud Zayin, Rabbi Yaakov says, first he said, I'm doing the second one first, the safest at first. Yofe shah acha shel koras ruach ba'olam haba mikol chaya ha'olam hazeh. Says Rabbi Yaakov, that a moment of koras ruach in olam haba, in the world to come, koras ruach, says a lot of the achronim say that koras ruach is not the real enjoyment of olam haba, it's not the real thing. Koras ruach is like when you're invited to dinner somewhere, and you're quite hungry, and you come in and you smell the food. But that pleasure, relating to the actual pleasure of sitting down at the table and eating with everybody, is what Koras Ruach is compared to real Olam Haba. It's just the pleasure of when you come in just smelling what's going on there. That's Koras Ruach. One moment of that pleasure, says Rabbi Yaakov, and he knew, exceeds all the pleasures of Olam Haba. So think of all your favorite things, and put them all in a big bundle, and tie a pretty bow on them, and one moment of just the smell of olam haba is far nicer than the whole lot of that put together. Okay, but Rabbi Yaakov also says something else. He says, "Yofe shor achas b'tshuva ma'asim tovim b'olam hazeh." One moment in tshuva and ma'asim tovim, in doing tshuva and good deeds, keeping halacha in this world, is better, is nicer, mikol chayei ha'olam haba, is better than the whole olam haba, the real one, not the smell, the real thing. So now we've got our scale of values. Think of the most wonderful things you can imagine and pile them all together, as much of them as you want. if you're cruising in the Caribbean is your idea of fun, imagine 1,000 years cruising in the Caribbean without getting bored. And if playing cards is your favorite thing, imagine 50 years of playing cards without getting bored. And if they're both, imagine playing cards for 100 years on a cruiser in the Caribbean for 100 years. And so on and so forth. Pile all your best things together. And one moment of the smell of Olam Haba is better than that. But one moment in Olam Haba of doing a mitzvah right, of doing it correct, of being totally committed to Torah, one moment of the feeling of total commitment to Torah exceeds all the pleasure of Olam Haba. That's why the Olam Haba is no tempter to us. It doesn't tempt us, Olam Haba. We don't sit and think mystically about the wonders of Olam Haba. Olam Haba is better. We love life better than death. Because a moment of living properly is more pleasurable and more meaningful than all the Olam Haba put together. That's what a moment is. That's how valuable our time is. That's what one can achieve. We spend our whole lives working to get to Olam Haba. And here the Torah tells us you don't have to do that. You can get to Olam Haba in one moment if you do it properly. That's what a moment is. If that's a moment, would anybody think of not buying time with money? Anybody think of not going to their employers and saying, look, you pay me 5 rand an hour, I'll pay you 20 rand an hour not to work. Okay, so you can't do that because you need the 20 rand. So you work it on a time. I'll pay 20 rand an hour not to work half an hour a day. And that half hour, you know what you'll do with it if you've paid for that half hour. Because we are from the acquisitive society and we only value time that we've paid for. So if you would pay for your time, take a day's unpaid leave and see how you work. See how you utilize that time far better than your unpaid leave. Different thing altogether, because money is still our means of reckoning. But that's what we've got to try and change when we're talking about Aliyah B'Torah, when one's talking about raising oneself in Torah. What one's talking about is changing the currency. This is the currency. Moment. Each moment is a life. Not that one moment leads to another moment and the whole lot together are one life. Each moment is an infinite life during which an entire Olam Haba can not only be acquired but also experienced. More than the whole Olam Haba can be experienced in one moment. That you've got to be in that moment utilizing your absolute potential of heart, of generosity, of giving, of emotions, of feelings, of intellect, of soul. Everything together, your total personality has to be operating for that one moment. And it has to be a moment of commitment to Torah, and then you'll experience what Rabbi Yaakov is talking about. And then you'll understand what it is time, what it means to have time and what time is all about. And now one can understand at least the concepts involved in the machlokes between the men and the women. The women were called Noshim Tzadkaniyos. They were righteous women. That means their joy came from being righteous. Their joy came, and not the Christian fadidadi idea of righteousness. We're talking about this, what we've just learnt. Righteousness. We're talking about being a tzaddik. The women's joy in life came from being a tzaddik. The men, acquisition. They used to have what they used to want to have, they used to want to possess. The other way around, you know, and nowadays the husband wants to go off to the shir and the wife says, how can you go off to the shir and leave me all alone with the children and all this? How can you do such a thing? What's going on? It's the woman is the acquisitive one. The man wants to get some experience and wants to live a little bit, and the woman is holding him back. In those days it was the other way. It was the woman who kicked him out of bed. Get to shul, come on, you're late. Out. Go and do something with your life. What are you lying around? Going to work, you're working too hard, the woman would say. How the woman would say, work a bit harder, earn a bit more. What's wrong with you? Where's your promotion? All your friends have been promoted already, and you? Busy learning Gemara. What's going on? How are we ever going to afford that house we're trying to buy? So it's changed. The roles have changed altogether. In those days, it was different. It was the Noshim Tzadkaniyos, it was the women who were righteous, and who understood the importance of spending money on living, not on having. And it was the men who had the problem. And it was through the women that Am Yisrael actually came to Eretz Yisrael. In fact, the Gemara says it was bizchus noshim tzidkanias. It was because of the women. It was the merit of the women that the men actually achieved the greatness that led them into Eretz Yisrael. So the Goyishka statement of the behind every successful man there's a, or behind every great man there's a great woman, that's from Torah. That's from our sources. Man can't operate unless his wife is behind him. That's it. So now the pasuk makes a lot of sense altogether. So it doesn't make so much sense. And in these, there was not a single man that survived from the time of coming out of Egypt. Those men were not capable of going into Eretz Yisrael. They preferred Egypt. And there was no chance of going back to Egypt, so they had to opt for death. That was it. You don't want Eretz Yisrael? Okay. You think you're going to go back to Egypt? That not. You'll perish here in the desert. But the women did get into Eretz Yisrael because they were geared from the beginning to handling the joys of life, the joys of living. They were geared from the beginning to understand that earning money is only a means of living, of doing things, and that having possessions is only a means of doing things. And that's what led them to that greatness. I just want to finish off, just to leave it in a practical sense that it's handleable. Is the Mishnah, there's a famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, the pat b'melach teichol, you should eat salt and bread, the mayim b'mashura tishten, just a little bit of water, the ala aretz tishon, and you should sleep on the floor, live in a very Spartan sort of life, and if you do that, then ashrecha b'olam hazeh v'tevlach l'olam haba, then you'll be good in olam hazeh, it'll be good for you both in olam hazeh and olam haba. And from there many people take it that the Torah despises materialism. That's not true. If one looks at Rashi there, you see that Rashi said that's talking to poor people. It says a poor man must know that he mustn't postpone his learning until he can afford it. You learn now, whether you can afford it or not. Your business, that's something else, but you don't learn and then you don't earn money and then go and learn Torah. You learn Torah all the time. But more than that, what the Mishnah is telling us there is that our needs are really very basic. What do you need? Bread, salt, water, and the floor to sleep on. That's all you need. Everything else we've got. Rashi is right, of course, that the Mishnah is not coming to tell us that you must throw out your wealth. The Mishnah is not coming to tell you to sell your house and live outside in a tent. And the Mishnah is not trying to tell you to never have any decent food again, just eat bread and water and salt. That's not, says Rashi, of course not. But what the Mishnah is telling you is that what you really need is just those things. What's the rest? The rest we have to relate to, like you can have an ambassador. Imagine an ambassador doesn't earn terribly much money. So let's say he earns 1,000 rand a month or whatever it is. But they put him in a fancy house and they give him a fleet of motor cars and he has a big entertaining allowance. And so he lives like a king. Obviously he lives like a king because he's representing a country. It wouldn't be, according to the COVID, of a country if he was living poorly, nor would he be able to do his job properly if he was living poorly. An ambassador needs the material tools, the wherewithal, to do his job. But woe betide the ambassador who begins to get attached to these things. Because there comes a time when he's recalled and he's given a job back home and he has no fancy house and he goes back to his old 3-room flat and he's got no car and he goes to work on a bicycle. And what's happened to all his wealth? So an ambassador has to adjust himself to understand that wealth isn't his. All he has is his little 2-room flat back in Tel Aviv or in Washington or wherever it is, and this is simply the tools he's been given with which to work. Same as a workman works in a factory with machinery. He never thinks the machinery is his. The machinery has been entrusted to him to operate and to do his job. And so one has to understand that the things that one has beyond pat, melach, mayim, bread, water, salt, a piece of land to sleep on, anything you have beyond that, the Rabbeinu Shalom has given you in order to do a job. It's not the Jewish way of thinking that if the Rabbeinu Shalom has given you more than that, that you should despise it and throw it out. The Rabbeinu Shalom has given you more than that, he wants you to do a job with it. He requires you to use that and to utilize it to make yourself potent in the world, to enable you to interrelate with the world, to enable you to give to the world and impose on the world. And yet one has to use one's tools. One isn't permitted to possess anything or to become attached to anything in a way that you need it. It's temporary. We don't know how long we've got it for, nor do we really care how long we've got it for. As long as we've got it, the Rebbeinu Shalom wants us to do a job of work. When the job's over, he'll take it away. That's it. And then he wants us to do another job of work to do. It's not terribly serious to lose money for a Jew. Is emunah, when we talk about emunah, we don't talk about it along the line that, oh, it doesn't matter, I'll be rich again in the future sometime. Who says? Emunah means, who says I need to be rich? When I have a job to do that requires wealth, the Rebbeinu Shalom will give me wealth, and if he wants me then to do something else, he'll take the wealth away from me. That doesn't matter. It doesn't deprive me of my security. It doesn't deprive me of my ability to enjoy myself, because my enjoyment, my fulfillment, and my security doesn't come at all from what I have, but only from what I do.